So this is Krista Whitney, and today is December 14th, 2012. I'm here in Chicago with Emil Karafiel, and we're going to record an interview as part of the Yiddish Book Center's Wexler Oral History Project. Emil, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
All right. So to start, can you tell me what you know about your family background, let's say your grandparents' generation?
Okay. I'll go back a little further, because I don't know my grandparents any better than I know my great-grandparents, you know, the way things happened. So my mother's father's family is from Warsaw and Poland. My mother's mother's family is from Lithuania, though I think she may have been brought up in Poland. Both of them were rabbinical families. My father's father's family, more recently, as far as I know, I mean, everybody has genealogy, but leaving us, I'm talking of real relations. My mother's grandfather may have been the first rabbi in the family, in that line, for at least some generations. He became the grand rabbi of Warsaw. So he became a big figure in Warsaw at the... He died around 1900, 1902, 1904, I don't remember. He's in the encyclopedia. Very Orthodox, when I say that. And my mother's father, her grandfather, his wife was from a much older rabbinical family, and they had ties all over Poland and Lithuania. The one I know about is in what used to be called Szczecin today, I believe it's Wrocław. Breslau is Wrocław. Szczecin, I guess it's in Polish. So these names change. So that's where her mother's brother was rabbi, and her mother's father succeeded by his brother. And where my mother's mother went back from Warsaw when she was old and lived there in the last years of her life. My father's family was very different, at least the branch that I know, which is my father's father's family. They were based in Gdańsk. They were in the lumber business going back to the early 19th century. Which meant they did lumbering in the north, in Estonia or whatever, wherever the river Vistula begins, or ends, I mean. No, begins, way up in the top. And it would come down to Gdansk, Danzig. And so they were in that for several generations. My father's mother was from Lublin. And my father was actually... The family business started going down as several generations died young, and about 1900, I think they went bankrupt or they closed that shop. Now, his father had moved out since. When he got married, he moved to Saxony in Germany. His main non-Jewish language was German, from Gdansk. And that's where my father was brought up. He was born in Lublin because his mother went back there to have a child. but he was brought up in a town called Plauen in Saxony, which was the center of the some kind of textile industry, lace industry, that's what it was. Still is a little bit. And that's what his father was doing. And so he grew up in Germany. And I do know, though, that his grandfather, Leo Leip, is buried in the Warsaw Cemetery. He died when he was on some trip in Warsaw, some charitable thing there. And the one thing I know about my father was totally irreligious, and my mother's family would have been opposed to the marriage, except for the grandfather, who was known in the Orthodox community of Warsaw. So that's sort of the general background of the family. I can tell you a little more.
Sure.
You know, my mother's family was a large family, lots of kids. She was one of the youngest. The oldest was maybe 20 years older than her. All the men had their rabbinates, and most of them went into that, as far as I know. I don't think they stayed outside the rabbinical world, though they didn't necessarily become rabbis, I mean, different things. And she had a sister who was secular like herself, and they lived together for many years. I mean, even after my mother got married, they lived together. So Gutta Gittel, who worked for Heint, she was a kind of glorified copy editor, as far as I know. I'm not sure, as best I can tell. Try to translate what I remember as a child, what I was told about her as a child, into terminology that's familiar to me today. So that's sort of what it looks like. But you know, some of my mother was very close to some of her brothers, and not at all close to other brothers. You know, that's in any big family it is. One brother's daughter married an American, and they lived in Florida, and she was in touch with them, of course. This was a brother who did not get along with her, but I don't think I ever met them. I met their daughter a few times when she was in college, by the time I was in college. But that's the closest contact I've had with them. Her oldest brother, who was a very was a rabbinical scholar, who barely made a living in Warsaw. He had three sons and a daughter. He's actually described in Heimgrad as their Mama Shabbosim, because he was the father. His daughter married Heimgrade. That was Heimgrade's wife, who did not follow him to Russia finally. And so she was a nurse in Vilna. And he was very close. He was very close to my father. I mean, they were opposite poles, but he used to sit and talk for hours and in mixed languages. But he would have coffee at our house. He wouldn't eat there, of course, but he would have coffee at our house. So his three sons all became secular Zionists. A Zionist in those days meant secular, of course. And they went to as it was then called, Palestine, and as the Zionists called it in Palestine. And when the third one went off, the youngest, was also described in Grada's book a little. When they went off, he followed them where he became a scholar in a project to revise the Talmud after 250 years, and I don't know how far they got. And he lived till after the war and died shortly after the war. I never met him. His widow lived on a while longer. And his three sons, the youngest one was killed the last day of the War of Liberation, or whatever it's called today. And the other two survived and had families.
Are there any family stories that have been passed down through the generations in your family?
Well, the one story that I know well has to do with my mother. I don't know any of the stories of her. She'd told me some stories about her grandfather. When she was a teeny little baby girl, he used to allow her to be under the table when he did an arbitration. A few times she was maybe four or five, and you know, and he died shortly after, and so a few stories of those. But the one that's always stood in my mind, because it's an example of Orthodox culture living on. My mother was a very Orthodox secularist. When her path there began with a young woman from a small town came, you know, 18-year-old or 17 or whatever, came to Warsaw, left home, and the local rabbi wanted her watched over. So he wrote my grandfather, could he watch over her? And my grandfather decided the best way was to give her a job. She would be the tutor to his daughter, because girls were not sent to school, not of these families. He would be the tutor for his daughter, for Haya, and in return she would get all her dinners, which of course meant that she had to be there every day for the dinners. And she did this for about a year, and then she told my mother, you know, she was ready to move on. But she also told her, I've taught you everything I know. I've barely finished, you know, whatever, third grade, whatever she finished, because she came from a poor family. So she did go to school, but not very long. But you should go to school. So my mother informed her parents that she wanted to go to school. And they said, no, sorry, you can't go to school. So she went on a hunger strike. And she was maybe 11, 12 around that time. And she went on the hunger strike for almost 2 weeks. That's what she told me. Maybe true, false memory, I don't know. But she went on, and finally they gave in. They said, okay. So they sent her to a Jewish, obviously not an Orthodox Jewish school, because those don't deal with girls. That's how she got to school. So that was her first step away. When she was at the university, she decided, because she went on to the University of Warsaw, then studied in Paris, that she decided that she really wasn't religious. At least not in the sense of observant. And so on Yom Kippur, when she was, what, 18 maybe, or something like that, she went into a cafe. And her first time in her life, she ordered a coffee. She drank it. She wrote a letter. And she paid for it with money that she held in her hands. And then she came home, and either then or a day or two later, she told her parents. And at least her mother, I don't know if her mother, her father was still alive, but she told her family. And their reaction was, well, at least you did what you believed in. And she told me, she knew that if she had come home, she had expected they'd throw her out. But she knew that if she had come home and said, you know, I've decided I'm going to keep kosher at home, but I'm going to eat non-kosher out, they would have thrown her out. It's either or. And she had that same Orthodox culture, I didn't realize that until much later in my life, with respect to her secularism. I have not had a bar mitzvah. We never went to shul. And we never joined any religious organization. And when I wanted to learn Hebrew as a child, I was sent to a Volksschule, where they didn't teach any Hebrew, instead of to a Talmud Torah, where I would have learned some at least. So I never learned Hebrew. So that was as I got older, as I got much older, I don't agree with that position. I'm no longer Orthodox.
Orthodox, secular.
Orthodox, secular, or Orthodox otherwise. I don't agree with that position. Religion has a much larger role, and observance is important, but there's a range. though by and large, it's probably true that historically Jews have been preserved by the observant. The others do drop off. There are a lot of Polish Jews intermarried, far more than were ever admitted, and in the ancient world too, there was at one time, there are estimates that at the time of Jesus, maybe as much as 10%, maybe, certainly over 5% of the urban population in the Roman world viewed themselves as Jewish. But most of them were not completely observant in those, even in those terms, and they dropped off.
So. Well, I want to talk more about your mother in a little bit, but I know that you were a young child in Warsaw just for a few years, but I'm wondering what memories do you have? What images or scenes do you remember?
Oh, I remember fish in a fish tank at home, because that's how we had fish. We brought them live. I remember I had to have an operation when I was born, pyloric spasm. And they were very common in America at the time, but the ones that were successful were done in Germany, and I couldn't go to Germany. So I was the first successful one in Poland. So I had that operation. I lived through it. That I don't remember. But what it meant was that my mother lost her milk. And while at that time bottled milk was coming in, my mother's doctor said, no, he needs real milk, mother's milk. So we got a wet nurse. And the wet nurse stayed with us till for 4 years. And I remember her very well.
Can you describe her? What do you remember about her?
Oh, that she was very warm and very close to me, and I was very close to her. I never confused her with my mother, but she was somebody who was very close to me. And then I just wish I'd gotten her name from my mother before my mother died. But I didn't go back to Poland for a very long time. Not really till the 1990s. When I bummed around Europe, I thought I'd go to Poland. I was in East Germany after college and so on. But I was told that in Poland, my Canadian passport, I then was a Canadian, would not trump my Polish birth. And I could conceivably be drafted. And the last thing I wanted was to be drafted into the Polish army. I didn't go back for a very long time, but I just remember scenes. That's all.
What about the home? Do you remember anything about your home?
I remember the apartment that we had on Mazowiecka. That's where they moved in after I was born, and I've been there. That house has remained, and. I remember you were there, right, with me, and I remember the park outside, sort of it's an apartment house around, and I remember the pigeons that came. They were my favorites that I played with, so I remember those scenes, but that's about all. The first scene that I really remember is leaving Warsaw. I remember being at the train station and getting on the train to Paris with my mother and sister. My father was already somewhere traveling. And a lot of people, my aunt and several others were seeing us off. And we got on the train and that was that. And that's I do remember my aunt, but again, would I recognize her? I doubt it. But I do remember her. I remember some of the cafes. I remember being taken to. The names I've forgotten in the last 5 years, because names have started to escape me completely. But remember, I took you to some couple where I would be taken for a special, whatever the Polish equivalent is of a Sunday or whatever.
So growing up maybe I'll get back to that question later, but so you were in Paris for a little while and then...
Well, we came... the other thing I remember about Warsaw, though, this may be a learned memory than otherwise, is that every language was spoken there. And my mother told me later that I was very late learning to speak. And in fact, when I was three, I do remember not speaking, I mean Polish even, having trouble speaking. Even when I was four, I wasn't as fluent as I could have been. And she took me again to her old doctor and friend, and her doctor told her, don't worry, he'll talk your head off someday, as you can see. So that was another effect of, I later learned, of hearing many languages as a child. If you hear learned languages at home, you have trouble excluding sounds. And if you don't exclude sounds, you don't learn sounds.
So what were the languages in Warsaw?
Polish, of course. German. My parents spoke German to each other. They also had friends. My mother, my sister's native language is German. She was born in Berlin. Half-sister. Her mother died. Her mother was Russian. She died in 1932. And when my sister was six. About six. And Russian, a lot of Russian friends. French, less so, but French friends. Polish, Yiddish, German, Russian, French. I think those were the languages that I spoke.
And who spoke Yiddish?
Just about everybody in the house spoke some Yiddish. I don't know. My sister is a fantastic linguist for learning spoken languages. Put her in any country, and in 3 weeks she's speaking the language. She doesn't write any language very well. English, obviously, but probably a little. She retains these. She still speaks a native German, native Polish, French. She was in Russia she was in the theater, and she went in Russia there for a few months, and by the time she left, she spoke Russian. They went to Czechoslovakia for a few weeks. We lived in Portugal. She learned Portuguese. She still speaks Portuguese. So she would have spoken that. But other than Yiddish, German, Polish. My father was spoken German, a little Polish, probably a little Yiddish. My aunt would speak Polish, probably Russian, and Yiddish. I think my mother was probably the only one who spoke French in that household. And she also could speak Spanish a little.
So from Paris, you spent a little time in Paris and then went to Lisbon.
We spent a year in Paris. We arrived in Paris not long before the war, outbreak of war. My father joined the army there. He joined the Polish division of the French army. How he got to Poland is another story, but that's a different story. And he, because he was in Germany until Hitler.
Why don't you tell me that story, and then we can go back to Paris.
Well, my father was brought up in Saxony. He then went to Berlin. His father died. His mother did not want my father to go to university. His older brother had become a singer, and she just had it with that. So she insisted that he was going to be apprenticed to relatives or friends who owned a department store in England, but the war had broken out. So he was apprenticed to somebody to Berlin in a department store. And he went there when he was 17, and he immediately got involved in politics, anti-war politics. He worked with a group of people who were hiding war deserters. He said he knew every brothel in the city, because that's where they were hidden. And he was arrested and given 6 years in jail. And then when the war ended, he was released. And he was one of the early members of the German Communist Party and was active there. He was doing all kinds of organizing, went back, organized were seamen in Danzig, in Gdansk, and then finally settled down to a job. He had a little business, but he was still political. He was in and out of the country. He was in Russia on a tour of Russia, with, led by the man who later became mayor of Berlin, West Berlin after the war, of our Berlin, Ernst Reuter. But he settled down. But he was in and out of the Communist Party until 1932, when they refused to oppose Hitler. Their theory was the worse the better. Like some people here thought, hey, if Sarah Palin gets elected, nominated, we'll be all right. That'll be the end of the Tea Party. Yeah, sure. So he dropped out then. In fact, took a leave from his business even, and was organizing street fighters, what we call terrorists, to stop Hitler. But of course, as soon as Hitler, at the night of the Reichstag fire, he was arrested. His wife was dead, a friend of his, who was an anarchist, took care of my sister for a few months. Later, it turned out that he became a Nazi too. My father's partner became a Nazi right after. He said, I don't mean you. But he got out somehow, probably cost money. He was in the cellars of the SA for a couple of months. He got out and had a pass, 24-hour pass, took my sister. They went to Prague, where the German political emigration went. And then nothing was happening, as he suspected. So he went to Poland, where his mother lived, hoping she would maybe take care of his daughter. And there he met my mother, and they got together, and they had common friends. My mother frequently visited people living in his apartment house in Berlin. You know, it's a small world. And so they had common friends, it turned out. They got together. He subsequently, he was still active politically. He wasn't working. He went to Spain as a correspondent, quote unquote, for a German émigré paper. Was arrested by the communists. My mother got him out somehow. Was very lucky, because they had a vendetta against him.
At that point, the Communist Party was against him?
Oh yes, after 32, he was enemy. And he made it clear that he was enemy. He was close to the PUM, ideologically, to the anarchist movement, which is described in George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia, if you ever read it. That's the group. You've read it? Yeah, so you know what I'm talking about, the world I'm talking about. But after the PUM rising, he got arrested. And then that was almost 38. And then in 39, they were in Paris. And my father joined the army. And we stayed. My mother found a job. She could find a job almost anywhere. And she had studied in Paris at the Institute of Statistics. And we stayed till June of 40. We left the same weekend that Humphrey Bogart left. But he went to Casablanca, and we went by way of Bordeaux and other cities and ended up in Lisbon, Portugal. I remember that trip.
Yeah. What was Paris like at that time?
Well, Paris itself, I don't remember. I mean, I remember it owns a child. I have a child's view of Paris. I remember the Luxembourg Gardens, and I didn't learn French. I didn't play with any children there, except sometimes in the garden you play with kids, but I didn't know any French. I know only Polish, and the only French I learned was my address in French. So when I got lost once, I could say it, and they took me home. But I remember the Eiffel Tower. I remember, lights and things like that, but don't remember much of Paris as such. I remember leaving it. I remember the trip out. We went with massive refugees leaving Paris at that time. There is a French movie, Les Jeux Interdits, The Forbidden Games, which, if you get a chance, you should see. It's a wonderful movie. And the scenes of people leaving Paris with children, they just brought it to life, you know. I don't know if it's a real memory or a cinematic memory, but that brought to life. And we first went to Bordeaux. I don't know why, where we stayed. We were in Bordeaux during the bombardment of Bordeaux, which was a very exciting time for me because we were in the cellar of a large apartment house, and there were cracks in the wooden thing, and I could see the house across was destroyed, or largely destroyed. And it was like, there was no TV in those days. This was a video game in real life. And I treated it as a game as a, you know, old 5-year-old child in 1940. And so I remember that. I remember a scene walking, and our house itself was hit, the top floors were hit. And I remember the wreckage when we came out. I mean, it was that and Rotterdam were the two big bombardments by the Germans. Both ports, both had some military significance. I remember walking along the street with my sister, who was then, I guess, 14. She was taking me. The next day it was sunny, beautiful sunny day. And this was June. And she was taking me down the street, and there was a loose electric wire. And it hit somebody. She just grabbed me and turned me around. And I don't know if he was killed or not, but I do know I remember that scene as one of terror for a moment. And that's all I saw. A very peaceful way to see the war. And, you know, in Paris, I also remember going to air raid shelters when there were not real air raids. Then we went on, and eventually we crossed the border, which is another story, but not interesting here. We went to Spain, and we got to Portugal, where we had a visa. We were among the people who got visas to Portugal from a Portuguese consul who was giving visas. And my mother found work there, too, there she worked for the joint, with her languages and her experience and so on. She worked for them. And my father and I went to school. And I went to a French school there. My mother was going to send me and my sister to a English boarding school. But my sister, after 1 week, said, no, she wants to be in Lisbon. School was not for her at any time. She wasn't going to leave a 5-year-old alone in a boarding school. So I went to this French lycée, where they had no room in kindergarten, so they put me in grade 1, which was okay. There were a lot of foreigners there, some wearing swastikas, some wearing freedom things in that school. It was a Vichy school. It was run by the Vichy government. And I learned French there. I had a wonderful teacher, whom I admire to this day and remember. And one thing that left me with, she was an admirer of Pétain and conservative French. And to this day, I can't take Pétain as badly as I take the others. Somehow Pétain, in my heart, is all right, even though he's a son of a bitch. Anyway, so that's, and then my father was, he was wounded, badly wounded in the war. His whole regiment crossed over into Switzerland, and he was interned. And I think my mother was finding ways that we could get to Switzerland if she could find some work there and be there too. But he was afraid that Switzerland was going to join Germany. I mean, everything we've learned since about Swiss collaboration and so on was, I knew that as a child from him. And the mood, at least in German Switzerland, was totally pro-German. not necessarily pro-Nazi, but pro-German at that time. And he was afraid they would join it, which they did mainly because they were more useful to Germany as a neutral country. And he knew if they did, he'd be done for. So he joined a group that British were spiriting these interned soldiers away, and then they could rejoin the army. And the Swiss were only too happy to let them go. So he came in part on foot from Switzerland to Lisbon, but to do this with lungs that had been shot, that had developed tuberculosis, was not good. And he really remained an invalid the rest of his life. So he joined us in Lisbon, and we couldn't stay because he wasn't there legally. And while Portugal was a sort of an English satellite at the time, they couldn't allow escaped prisoners of war to live there indefinitely. That just wouldn't work. So the English gave us a choice of Canada or Australia. And my mother tried to get a transit visa through the United States. She was good at getting visas for people, and she knew that once you entered the United States legally, you could stay. You didn't want to enter it illegally, but once you entered legally, you could get extensions. But the problem was that just at that point, a decree came out preparing for World War II that nobody with relatives in occupied countries could come to the country, the United States. It lasted until Pearl Harbor, approximately. But they didn't want masses of spies coming in, I guess, or whatever. So we couldn't get in. So we came to Canada. And we were given, I say Canada or Australia, Canada was closer. And we came to Canada for the duration of the war and stayed. My parents didn't intend to stay. But after, we didn't become citizens till fairly late. But within a couple of years after the war. My sister got married, that was one factor, but going back to Poland was impossible. Not only because of the Holocaust, but because of the communists. My mother was a Bundist, also active politically. Neither of them would have lived long under the communist regime. And going back to Germany, my father would have gone back to Germany. Because my father fought against Germany as a German patriot. As a bitter anti-Hitler German patriot. And sort of like the future prime minister of Germany, the Kanzler. What was his name? The one who had fought in the Danish army.
Remember.
The socialist. The one who went to, the first one to go to Auschwitz and do a kind of a penance. Willy Brandt. This, not before your time, before your time. He was the first socialist chancellor of Germany after the war, like in the 60s or 50s or 60s, I don't know. But my mother wouldn't go back to Germany. She'd go to Germany. She lived there, but she wouldn't go there. And so for a while they thought of going to France, where my father could have had, we could have had French citizenship because of his army. He was decorated, actually a decorated soldier. But they didn't do that. They stayed in Canada. And I lived in Canada until I was 16. I went through school there. And then I went to college in the States. And that's sort of the story of my childhood. Nothing interesting happened to me after that. That was it.
Well, Montreal really was a special city in terms of Yiddish culture. And I'm wondering if you can describe the home your parents created in Montreal once you got there?
Well, it wasn't very self-consciously a home of Yiddish culture, as it might be today. It was their home. And there were other languages spoken, and there were other peoples. Where we lived, we became friends with our neighbor upstairs. Not close friends, because, and he was close to, this was a relative of his, was a Catholic priest who was headed a Catholic school. And at that point, if I hadn't already been going to English public schools, my mother intended to send me to the French schools. In Montreal, there was at that time a sharp division between Catholic and Protestant schools. The Protestant schools, except for the daily prayer, were basically secular. The Catholic schools, the public ones, were run by the parish priests and were very Catholic. There were everybody who was French Canadian who could afford to send their children to a private Catholic school, which was comparable to those here, much more intellectual, especially the Jesuit ones were very good. Humanistic, not scientific, but very good. But in any case, she just figured I already knew Polish, I knew French. To learn English was just too much at this point. The trouble is that for a Jew to go to a Catholic school, and there were English Catholic schools too, by the way, but she wanted to a French school, you have to pay money. For a Catholic to go to a Protestant school, you have to pay money. It's like going to a suburban school when you live in the city, and vice versa, which we didn't have, of course. So I went to the English schools and learned English, and I'm delighted I did. But we had close friends. Well, they were close friends of ours. But still, almost all of our friends were Jewish. A number of them were, my mother's center was the Workman Circle, the Abitabling, the library. She actually taught French at the Jewish Public Library for immigrants who needed to learn French for jobs. So this was her work in Montreal for a few years, was doing that and other things too, but that was part of it. So those were the organizational centers, I would say. She was also still active in the Bund, and there were a lot of, this was by this time more of a social than a political organization, but there were a lot of Bundists in among the Jewish population in Montreal. So that was a large circle, which overlapped with the Workman Circle, with the Jewish Public Library. It was one world with several circles. And these were our circles.
And at home in Montreal, what language would you speak?
From the time I was about eight, Yiddish. My parents stopped speaking German. I think my mother really didn't want to speak German. And partly because we knew what was happening. My father wouldn't believe it. I remember the arguments. He said, no, this is just like World War I. Look at all the lies that were spread by both sides about World War I. And some very famous English historians, Arnold Toynbee wrote a book then on German atrocities in Belgium in World War I, which was mostly made up. I mean, he didn't make it up, he believed it. It's an interesting little book. And my father just wouldn't believe that. He believed all kinds of horrible things, but that they would do that. It's got to be stories. But my mother did, and who was the Jewish member of the Polish government in exile who committed suicide in protest against everybody's silence? Ziegelboyen? No, I don't remember his name. I mix up names. That was, I think, in 43, and she knew that. She knew that. So part of it that she didn't want to speak German, partly also, and to speak German in a largely Yiddish area, I think she decided no. So they began speaking Yiddish, and he became a great fan of Yiddish literature. He learned to read it that he hadn't before. So he read everything, Peretz, Shalom Aleichem, you name it. He was a voracious reader, and at that point he started reading almost all Yiddish literature. And without becoming a Yiddishist at all, just fascinated.
And you read a lot of Yiddish literature too.
I went to the Jewish Public Library a couple of times a week and usually took out one book in Yiddish or two and one book in English and read them and children's books. I stopped reading Yiddish as much when I got older, and this had to do with the Hebrew. Adult Yiddish literature has a lot of Hebrew in it. And it bothered me that I didn't know the words. I could look them up, but I read a novel, you have to look up a word every two paragraphs sometimes. So I wanted to learn, and I didn't. So when I went to college, I thought I would take Hebrew as a language. It wasn't taught in those days. So I went to Hillel, which was actually new. I didn't realize it was fairly new at Princeton at that time. Their quota was down, and they had a Hillel, and so on. And the rabbi was fairly new, too. But I was a difficult teenager, nerdy, difficult teenager. And I asked him if I could take some, they have some beginning Hebrew. He said, well, no, but they do intermediate Hebrew. But you can do that. So I said, no, I mean, I don't know any Hebrew at all. I need to begin at the beginning. Now, I probably could have done it. I mean, it's not... He said, well, I mean, you've had Hebrew for your bar mitzvah. So I said, no, I didn't have a bar mitzvah. He looked at me. You mean, you were brought up in the Jerusalem of North America, and you didn't have a bar mitzvah? And I said, you know, to myself, I said, well, screw you, I'm not coming back here. It was a very silly teenager reaction. I wish I had learned Hebrew then, but I never learned it.
I know that the Montreal Jewish Public Library was an important place for you at that time. Can you describe the you mentioned some of the librarians that you knew while you were there and the people that were around in the library?
I didn't necessarily mix with the people very much. My friends were not my friends' friends were not Yiddish readers, with one exception. But even he did, I wasn't quite in this circle. You probably know of him now. His name is Saki Berkovich, Saki von Berkovich, the Harvard professor of New England literature. But he and I read advanced English literature, advanced for our age. And, and I got that at the library too. I knew I used to get advice on books from the librarian, Rochel. Rochel Korn, by the way, whom I mixed up with the name, she was a good friend of ours. In fact, she lived with us for a little while when they came to Canada, she and her daughter. Her daughter, Irene Cooper-Smith, was my doctor all the years I was in Montreal. And on into my 20s, when I went back to Montreal, if I had any problem, I would see her. But I didn't have to that. And so she was a close friend of my mother's.
Well, what was Rachel Korn like? This figure, this writer.
Just a very intelligent person. I was surprised. I mean, I didn't realize that she was a poet even until later, you know. I mean, I knew she was a writer, but that she was quite as eminent a poet. I didn't read Yiddish poetry. I read stories. And some nonfiction, some history later, occasional essays, but mostly the sorts of things a teenager, even a precocious one, will read, which is even English poetry. I came to more during my college years, and I stayed with it than otherwise. I actually read French poetry more than I read even English. I read French in those days, too. And of course, the person who was a friend of ours, close friend of ours, I saw him at home, too, sometimes, was Melech Rabich. And he went, what can a 12-year-old say about Melech Rabich? He's a great man, you know? I don't know how much of a librarian he was, but he was a great man. He was a poet, a very well-known poet. And I wonder what's happened to his family. He had a child? I know he did, but I don't know what happened to him. I'm not in touch keeper very much.
So were you aware of, were you aware that these were sort of eminent figures?
Oh, yes, I was aware that Rabich was an eminent figure, and I was aware that my mother knew a fair number of eminent figures. Most of them did not survive. But for example, she was a very close friend of the two leaders of the Bund, Ehrlich and Alta, whom Stalin killed. And Ehrlich's wife came to New York. And I remember coming to New York with my mother once, and we stayed with her. And in fact, this is a sad story. My mother was in New York in 1968, and she was living there for a while. And she was on her way to have coffee in the evening with Mrs. Ehrlich, who lived a couple of blocks away from her when she was killed by a car in December of 1968, just about today, maybe the anniversary. I'm not sure, it's very close to the 14th. So she was very close to Mrs. Ehrlich. Mrs. Ehrlich was the daughter of the historian Dubnov, whom you know. And so that world was part of her world. And the other part of her world was Yiddish cabaret, my mother's. So that she knew all the songs. It hit me once when I was in, the first time I was back in Warsaw in the 90s, and I went to the then very small Jewish museum, and on the top floor they had was their Holocaust floor, which they had a wall of pictures and of famous Yiddish actors and cabaret singers, actors who were killed. And when I looked at them, almost all of them were my mother's generation. And I'm sure she knew them all. And
would she sing around the house?
Yes, to herself. She could sing almost any of these songs, but sort of like her. Not as good, not as many. But she knew those cabaret. She loved the Yiddish cabaret.
Did you go to the theater when you were growing up, or?
In Montreal, there wasn't much theater. There was a little English theater, a little French theater. Later in New York, I did. My mother was there. But the interesting thing is, she loved the theater. She did not go to the Yiddish theater in New York, maybe once or twice. She never suggested we go to the Yiddish theater, and I'm sure she didn't. And at that time, it didn't strike me, because I wasn't even aware how vibrant Yiddish theater was still in New York in the 1950s and 60s. So that was part of her certain resistance. So she was very active with Ivo, always.
Did
you maintain that relationship? Though not as, it came back more, but not as actively as she. So
did you go to any of the events at the Jewish Public Library in Montreal?
Some, I don't remember them. Most of them were for adults.
Yeah.
You know, I was 14, 15, turning 16. I just don't remember. I know I went to some commemorations, but I didn't go to talks and things. I still don't do that very much.
When you're given your mother's political and social relationships, did people come visit you, your home?
Oh, yes, hugely. In fact, one of the most... I got to know the Holocaust one summer. I think I was about 14, no, maybe 13, 14. We had a outside veranda, one flight up, outside stairs, outside veranda. And during that summer, not just then, but that was particularly that summer, it was like almost every evening, Holocaust survivors who came to the States on some kind of temporary visa, special visas, to get a full visa at that time, you have to leave the country to get the visa. So they would come to Montreal. Sometimes they would stay with us, but very often they would visit us. They were friends or they're friends of friends. And just about every evening for a summer, people would come up and there'd be 6, 8, 10, 12 people, not all from, some from Montreal, but some, several survivors. And that first wave, they talked. The repression came after for Holocaust survivors. As they made a life for themselves, as they had children here, they didn't want to talk about it anymore. And every night, I was allowed to stay up late. Usually if I wanted to stay up late, I had to hide in bed with a cover over and with a little flashlight so I could read silently. But which I'm sure my parents knew I was doing, but I was asleep. But I was allowed to stay up. Maybe I was 13. I'd have to reconstruct when it should have been, and I just don't remember. And every night, and they were there till 11, 12, 1, on weekends, because they came. And I would stay up. And I heard more stories about survivals, non-survivals, relation. I don't remember most of those stories. But it really made an impact on me. And later, as I read about the Holocaust, years later when people were writing, there was very little new. The Polish Holocaust, the Polish events, life in the ghetto, the Christian churches in the ghetto for converted Jews who were Jews under the Nazi laws. They might not have been under the Nuremberg laws, because the Nuremberg laws were a little looser than the Jewish laws in Poland, in the East, or in France for that matter, when they applied them. And the escapes to Russia. I heard a lot of stories about Russia, about life in Russia at the time. One of my favorite stories is a man who came. He lived in Montreal for a number of years with his family. His brother was a good friend of my mother's, from a kind of a mentor of hers from Warsaw, Lemkin, the genocide author, who was at Yale at this time, and then lived at Princeton, I believe, for a while, and whom I've met several times. And his brother was not like Lemkin. The Raphael was an intellectual scholar, et cetera, et cetera. This one was a matter-of-fact businessman in a small town in the east, in the part occupied by Russia. When the Russians occupied it, they did a census of what were people, what were their political views, at least with the Jewish, the middle-class population. And he told the story, and I remember his telling it, that every, many of his friends, they claimed they were socialists, they were immediately arrested. Orthodox communism, like Orthodox Judaism. But when they asked him what he was, he says, I'm a businessman. What do you do? I own real estate and I build. I'm a builder and a real estate owner. So they sent him and his wife and children to Moscow to run a construction firm. The juiciest job during the war. And he spent the war in Moscow with a good job, food, because I'm a capitalist, he said, a businessman. Okay, you're honest, we can use you. And then he told us a number of stories about life in Russia. I remember only a few of them. Those that stuck in my mind as having some larger significance. But I remember that summer very well. And that was the kind of life I had. Was it a self-conscious Jewish life? No. As far as religion goes, the only once there was a synagogue down the street. When I was a kid, 8 or 9, my friends were there playing, so I took an apple to eat on the way, and it was Yom Kippur. And my mother said, "Oh, you can't eat on Yom Kippur." So I said, "But all my friends do." You know, they weren't 13, so they could, right? She said, "Yes, but you don't eat in front of people who are fasting." That rule was established in the house. But at home, we could eat anything on Yom Kippur, even pork. Orthodox secularism. So but other than that, that was my world.
Did you celebrate any of the Yom Tovim in a secular way?
A little bit. Passover, we used to have a kolatzia. We had a Last Supper, so to speak, which is what the Seder started as, right? So, so we would have kolatzias with our other secular friends. Not a Passover, no reading of the thing. I knew what was going on. I was told what the holidays were about. I read about them, but we didn't. We didn't light candles on Hanukkah. I say it was a very... My father wasn't Orthodox secularist. He was just secular. And his home was, and he was. His father actually did belong to a synagogue, and I think his father was Reform at this time. And vaguely know a story. He was kicked out once for something. You know, intra-communal issues. But my father would have, if my mother had been a... I'm not sure he certainly would never himself become observant, but he could have lived in an observant place. He could have lived in a half-observant place. I mean, it didn't worry him. I asked my father, "Look, you're so secular. I mean, you're not religious at all. I mean, and unlike my mother, you know Yiddish, you like the literature, but you don't consider yourself, you know, a Yiddishist and so on." Though in those days, would have been more likely to go to Palestine than my mother, because it was in a place to escape to. Whereas for my mother, it would have been, you know, in a sense, betraying the Orthodox view of Zionism as heretical.
Bundist views, right.
Well, not the Bundist view, the Orthodox view. The Bundists were not so anti-Zionist. Her parents were anti-Zionist. And the oldest brother who went there, it was a big step for him. Because it's not through fighting and... Remember the old thing that the early Zionists, the goal was, as the founder said, for Jews to become a nation like all other nations. You know who said that before? Saul, in the debates with Samuel. And my mother's family was on Samuel's side. Jews are not a people like other peoples. And if God wants us back in Palestine, then she always called Israel. But all her Zionist friends called it Palestine. And then finally she learned to call it Palestine. And a year later it became Israel. But in any case, so it was, so my father was, but he said, so I asked him, "Look, you are so, why do you call yourself Jewish? When you write down, you know Yiddish, but why do you call yourself Jewish?" He said, "Because as long as there's one anti-Semite living in the world, I'm Jewish. I'll call myself Jewish. Let him know." So that's a different kind of approach. That's the home I grew up in. Enough of that.
Well, looking back, I'd like to ask you about some other things, but looking back on your childhood and your parents and the world that they were a part of, what were the values that you felt they were trying to pass on to you?
I can't put my finger on it. I mean, they didn't seem any particular. The values, I wasn't taught values as values. This value of my father's has been very important to me. I mean, I feel more Jewish than he did, especially as I got older. But though I was married before my first wife died, neither of my wives was Jewish. My mother, for all her secularism, was unhappy that my first wife was not Jewish. which sort of surprised me, because she had so many friends. Alta, the one of the two leaders of Bund, his wife wasn't Jewish, and there was a lot of mixed marriage in her circle. But I guess it's one thing to have mixed marriage in a Yiddish world, and it's another one to have it in a destroyed world. And I think that was the difference which I didn't grasp. So there were my father's statement, is that an ordinary value? No, but it's, I certainly learned the value of being an Orthodox at whatever I do much more than I should have been. I don't think it was the right value. You're either in or out. You either do it or you don't do it. If you're not doing it right, leave, do something else. That kind of, not teaching, but that kind of example. And it's a good value, but it has also misled me in a number of ways. And as I go back on it, it was a little too cut and dry. On the other hand, in so many other ways, both of them were very Jewish. In different ways, he was German, and very different. Brought up in Germany, at least, and dancing in Germany, that world. And my mother was, in many ways, a typical Jewish mother. I recognize that now.
So you became a historian and then a lawyer. Right. And I'm curious what drew you to European history.
Well, I was interested in history always. I wanted to know the past. I'm still interested in history. I was interested in academics. That was the positive attraction. I was interested in earlier periods. If I had known, if I had known Hebrew, I might have gone into Jewish history. I might have. I taught Jewish history at the University of Chicago. I was one of the first people who taught non-religious Jewish history. The last few years I taught a course in the assimilation of German Jewry. The emancipation of German Jewry. So it was taught from the German point of view, not from the Jewish point of view, from the middle of the 18th to the middle of the 19th century. And also, obviously, the circle, the Mendelssohn circle, all of whom converted within two generations. But I taught it as part of, I taught Central European history. My field was Austria-Hungary. Not quite Germany, but Austria-Hungary. And that was the affirmative. The negative, I was attracted negatively. I was escaping a little bit from the world. I didn't see myself as going. My mother wanted me to be a lawyer, of course, Jewish mother. Lawyer or doctor, I wasn't going to be a doctor, so be a lawyer. And she was right. I'm a good lawyer. I probably should have been a lawyer from the start. But I think some of it was escape. But my idea of becoming a teacher, in fact, was going to academics, was to go to teach in a smaller college. I got a job at the University of Chicago, so I took it. But that was not what I was aiming for. Any more than when I left and went to law, my goal was to become a solo practitioner. And I got a job at Kirkland, so I took it, stayed there. I've only had two jobs in my life. I mean, other than temps. And why the 18th, in many ways, I knew that even then. I studied the period between the religious wars and the modern ideological wars. I didn't want to study the ideological wars. And that's not just Nazism, but communism, the Cold War, basically until the French Revolution and starting in the middle of the 17th century, that was my period. The period when war was rational, fought by armies that treated civilians horribly, But still, there was a reason, there was a policy. I was interested in public administration, in the development of the state of public administration, and in political theory, and a lot in the literature of the period as well. No, I didn't teach that. So the world of the, my students, I think they were graduate students or the undergrad, maybe both. There was some event or other, and then they started playing a game. Which teacher would you go to if you went to another period? So if you had to go to the past and had to get a job, where would you go? Who would you go with? Oh, I'd go with Emil to Vienna. That's how I knew Vienna. I knew Vienna in the 18th century as a place where you could get how to get a job, where to find coffee, where people lived, what was going on. I didn't write about that, but I knew that. And that was my attitude to history. So I visited intensely. But it was a period, I say, between the religious wars and why did I change? I wasn't publishing. I had tenure. I got it because my students liked me, so they had not given tenure to one person who was a great teacher, and it turned out to be a great scholar too. They couldn't do it a second time in 3 years, so I got tenure, and both undergraduate and graduate students apparently fought for me, so that was nice, and. But I didn't go there to never write. I had a writing block. I still do. My dissertation was accepted for publication. I didn't like it, so I never sent it in, finally, for the publication. Well, I should have gone for counseling. And they were told, taught me to forget it. Just send it in and go on to do something else. Maybe I would have stayed in academics if I'd done that. But at any rate, I didn't want to do that. One person I know who's a cantor and a psychiatrist and a jazz singer, well, all three, an older man, very wise man, he told me that he thought, he sees me as having very much the life pattern of a Holocaust survivor. I read a lot about it. I heard the stories when I was 13 or 14. I read literature. I read memoirs. Then just stopped. I stopped following it. I knew about it. I read a few things, but I stopped following it. And it really was, in a way, with the Jewish Cemetery Project going back, that was, I know it's cause and effect. Engels said that everything in history is both cause and effect of the development in which it takes place. So it was both cause and effect. Things came back, in a way. The interest came back, in a way. But he told me that the years I left after I'd been teaching this course in German Jewish history for about 3 years, and he thought that may have had something to do with my leaving. I was getting too close to it again for my history, because I had not read much and so on about it before. Now this wasn't the Holocaust, but still it was very central to a development. He might have been right. But that aside, I was interested in the history of law. I'd spent a year doing a law fellowship once as a faculty member already. I got interested in the history of the law of the Holy Roman Empire, its administrative law, how it interacted with other things, more its legal administration, the general structure. And I knew I could do law. I knew I could earn a living at law. And you know, the downside economic risk for being an associate professor of history is very small. It was even smaller in those days than it is today. So I could always earn a living. So I decided I took my LSATs and went to law school. I was accepted. I wasn't going to go to a school like University of Chicago Law School, but I was told by someone, if you wanted a job, you've got to go to one of the top schools at your age and so on. Because he was thinking of a job like the one I got. I was thinking of becoming a solo practitioner. So I went to the University of Chicago. I did well there in the courses and stuff. I liked it. And And then I got a job as a lawyer, where I specialized not in litigation, because it was a little, the first years as a litigator, you write long memos on, you know, you do the history of the thing. I said, too close to history. So I went into transactional practice, venture capital, which became private equity. And that's how I became a lawyer.
And then what brought you back to an interest in Jewish culture? I know maybe
I always had an interest in it. I don't mean that I lost an interest in Jewish culture. I always did. I have a substantial library, many of them unread, from many years back. And I continued reading Yiddish from time to time, only books, and it got harder for me. That took me longer to read. I'm a slow reader even in English. And then I became a very slow reader in Yiddish. I used to read fast. I read Haim Grada's The Mamash Abosim. I read a fair amount of Singer, though my mother disapproved of Singer. You know who else disapproved of Singer?
Well, many people.
But you know what famous person disapproved of him?
Who?
Haim Grada. Did you know what he said?
You can tell me.
When Singer got his Nobel Prize, Haim Grada said publicly that it was a shanda. Singer wrote what was then considered sort of racy romance-type stuff. You know, unserious, because it often got, a lot of it got published, serialized in the Forvis.
And now many people, and even at the time, argued that Grada should have gotten it instead.
Many argued it even at the time, but Singer has far more appeal to, I think more non-Jewish readers read Singer than Grada. Am I right? I mean, does anybody read Grada in English? Except people who are interested in Jewish history or something. Nobody reads Grada as a poet, and that's what he really was, originally.
Right.
So nobody reads Yiddish poetry.
Yeah.
I mean, you do, I know, but it's not. Yeah. But in any case,
can you tell me about the Warsaw Cemetery project and
sure.
how
it, started
it came about?
My son and I went back, my first time back, and we wanted to get a register. Now, I won't tell you about the politics. That we were told there was no register, that it had all been destroyed. There, in fact, was one being made up by the head of the cemetery himself, and there were fights inside. He charged for people going to see the graves. The cemetery was terribly overgrown. The only grave I could see was the one of my grandnephew, Michal Klepfisch. So it was actually my son's idea. We should get a group of students. That was my first thought. American students to come in the summer and start writing down the names and locations of graves, create an index. Well, I realized after all that wouldn't have worked. It was much, and also it was overgrown. One needed to clear it a little. And I couldn't get through to anybody to clear my way. I wasn't going to go. I suppose I should have gone to the gemeinde and asked them, can I do this? But I'm not a doer in this sense. I'm not a person who breaks through things this way. So I got a contact, a friend of mine in Lublin, had contacts with the Lublin city assembly people, the government. And in Lublin, the Jewish cemetery is owned by the city. And I was about to go to for a meeting there to see if they would give me the permission to do this and what it involved and so on, when I read about all the 18,000 Jewish genealogical groups who are having disputes. And I said, no, I'm not getting involved in this kind of dispute. I went to Yivo, I'd gone before to, and I asked him, who can help me? And they gave me several names, actually, and two or three of them who were fairly well known really just wanted some money. But the one who was sympathetic was Rabbi Shudrick. And he opened the way. He did two things. He got the Gemina to allow me to do this. It was owned by them. And they agreed. And he also got me somebody who would act, would work for him, and who was advised people on Jewish cemetery matters. He was not a rabbi, but he would study this and knew this, and he was sort of a key advisor on these issues. And they arranged, they got me admission to the Warsaw to Okopova. And the head of the library of the Okopova greeted me, friendly. I thought we would work together. I didn't realize that he was not the one who years before had a register. That one did all kinds of nasty things, and I won't give his name, and he was fired, and so on. This one, what he did do is he continued, and he had his own register, which he didn't tell me about for years. And that register went online with the Lauder Center register. And they charged money for that. So we did our own. So I had, this young man, what's his name? I can't remember his name. You remember his name? No.
Give me a minute.
He's no longer involved. He was my, chief operating officer, so to speak. He was there. He got people from the university who came and worked on this. They were paid. And I the Gemina allowed me to do it through the Gemina. I gave money to the Gemina. They used it so that I wasn't going to do it where they didn't pay taxes and things like that. I had to be done totally kosher. This, as a lawyer, not just as an Orthodox secularist. It had to be done totally kosher. And so they did that, and so they ran the project, but I organized it, I went, I directed it with the help of the COO. And eventually, three or four people made it there, just about their life work. One of them left at the end to do something else. The other three stayed with the project after it ended. They're the three who are running the new center that they formed, which I was going to help them with, but I just didn't feel I could start something new. If they could organize it themselves and find others, fine. I couldn't. I just wasn't up to it intellectually. My mind wasn't there.
Can you back up just and give me, I know what it is, but can you explain what the concept behind the project?
The concept started out, it just grew. The concept started out as just a register, so people would know whose graves were there. And you get this register by going and checking the graves. Now if they're already, and so you get the location, the name on the grave, and maybe some other information from it. And that had to be written down, and that would be put on the web. And it would be accessible free to everybody. The Spielmann, the head of the Okopova, did not allow us to put the location. Somebody came to visit, he came, they would just walk all over the place. We have to guide them. Actually, charged a fee for showing people. That's what it turned out. I don't know if he still is there or not. I don't think so. I haven't been that much in touch the last couple of years. I mean, I'm in touch with my team, but and then after a while, early on, they said, it would be much faster and we'd get more done if we took photographs. And then we could enter the information, enter some of the information, but we could take it from the photograph later, in the evening, on rainy days when we can't work, etc., etc. Because you're limited in the cemetery, except especially in the winter, to what, 20, 30? You can only go when it's open, and within that time to maybe 20 hours a week or 30. So I thought, gee, that's a good idea, speed it up. Well, of course, it did nothing of the kind. Taking the photographs made it much longer, but it also made it much more interesting. It suddenly became a virtual cemetery. You could actually see the grave. And you still couldn't really see the location. That they have since gotten the Gemeinde to override Spielmann and to allow the location to be shown several years ago, right? One of them, Witold Wyszynski, he is outstanding at dealing with bureaucracies. Remek, who is exceptionally bright, he is not the best guy for dealing with bureaucracy. And Alicia is, she actually got interested in it because not in connection with the cemetery project, she wrote her master's dissertation on the cemetery and its history. So she got interested in it intellectually before. And she has a passionate interest in Jewish history and in Jewish events. Has she gotten her doctorate or she's getting it or whatever? And those three became the heart of it. And in fact, there is a movie. I don't know if it's on the website. I'm probably too shy to put it on the website. There's a movie about them. There's a movie about the project, but it's really about them and their work, which is tremendous. It was done by one of the best documentary people in Poland. His father was head of the National Film Society, you know, the government film thing that focused on documentaries and things, and a great documentary maker, filmmaker. And his son is a grown-up, and he's a, I wish I could remember that name, but I'll send it to you. And it was a very, very fine movie. But it really is on them and the work they do. The work this involved, you had to love it. You had to know Hebrew. You had to know Polish, of course. You had to know some English. At least a little. Alicia knows some, and Witold Wyszynski knows English well. He writes well. I think Remek is back. He went to Israel for several months. Was thinking of moving there, but I don't know if he has. I'm sure he hasn't. So that finally finished about two and a half years ago. But they've decided to go on. First they did, and I helped subsidize that too, and the Gmina pitched in with money too. For the main project. And I didn't raise it from outside. So I can't raise money for something I'm doing. But they did a whole series of small Jewish cemeteries in suburbs, exurbs of Warsaw. But their plan is to integrate this with the cemeteries all over Poland. Some of which have already been done by local groups, though not necessarily virtually. A few small ones have been done virtually. This has caught on. This has become a big thing since when we did it, I think we were the only ones to do any significant. We were about the first. Which had a register. There were registers in some. But I don't think there was anything like this kind of effort. And now there are. So they've formed a new organization, a parent organization, where the Warsaw Cemetery Project is a subsidiary, so to speak. And they've just recently entered into an arrangement with the community, the Gmina, that has transferred all of its rights to the project. Because it had rights. It supplied some of the money. It was on its location. We used their server. But the Gmina gave up a reach agreement where they have all of the Gmina's rights and support. So this new organization, which is on the website, is now doing, about to do, and for the three of them, is going to be their life's work. They'll be doing other things too, but they'll be running this.
So what interests you in supporting a project like this? Why was it important to you? Is it important to you?
Well, I believe in preserving history. This is my history. I found my grandparents' graves. I found my great-grandfather's Caraffio grave. And lots of that should be alive. If they found a, it's not the same thing. I don't want to claim it's the same thing, but if they found a grave of Ethiopian, pre-Roman Italian residents, a full grave of the pre-Roman, a full cemetery. And if I was really rich, if I had any money, in fact, and they asked me for a contribution, I'd make a contribution. I think those things should be preserved. I believe in preserving ancient cultures and the remnants of it. I would like to see a lot of the stolen archaeology returned, but it's still being stolen right and left through countries that will go unnamed. And I think that's a crime. But at least, especially if they're then sold for nothing, to be scrapped. But in addition to that, I have a bond. This is where my family lived, for my mother's family, for generations. I'm glad. I think they're going to do Lublin. I'm going to look for my grandmother's, if I can find her name somewhere. I suspect I can find it.
So, what has been the role of Yiddish in your life since growing up in this environment where Yiddish, you know, in reading Yiddish literature over your lifetime, how has your relationship to Yiddish maintained, changed?
It's part of me. I mean, it hasn't been a conscious, as I say, I haven't read much Yiddish. I have had very little opportunity to speak Yiddish. I know very few people I know some, but very few of my generation who are Americans or Canadians who speak Yiddish, except occasionally. In that sense, I've been a moral and to some extent, not hugely, but to some extent, a financial supporter of the Yiddish Book Center. I followed its history and what's going on there. And so whenever Aaron came to Chicago, I was there. And he used to come once a year at least. I don't think he does anymore. Does he? I don't think so. Doesn't travel much anymore. How old is he now? 70?
No, not quite. His children are in college, so he's...
So he's in his 50s. But when the Yiddish Book Center was started, when? What was the opening? Not in Amherst, but the opening of the entity.
In the 80s, so...
So 30, good 30 years ago.
But he was young.
Yeah, he was young. So in that sense, I can't say, but I mean, I would say the same thing. What role has American literature had in your life? I can't specify the role it's played. I've read a lot of it, and less recently than I would have liked to. One of the problems with universal literacy is that so much gets published. The 10 best books, every week a new list comes out. So, others could say it better than I. People who observe me, who know me, might be able to answer that question. But I can't say introspectively how much it's just part of me.
And why has philanthropy been important to you?
It's not been as important as it should have been, but it's something one should do, especially if causes that I know. And a lot of it has focused, you know, especially since I became a lawyer and could philanthropize. As a teacher, I couldn't philanthropize very much. You know, I gave pennies. But especially since then, and on Jewish institutions, you know, the Spertus Museum in Chicago. Again, I'm not on the board. I haven't been asked to be. I didn't want to be. I'm not that active there. But I am a supporter, and including of aspects of the Spertus Museum that the local Jewish community doesn't like. You heard of the scandal. Oh, they had an exhibit on Palestinians and Jews and Palestine, which, you know, it was objective in the sense it showed maps of the area written from an Israeli point of view, and next to it maps from a Palestinian point of view. It showed videos. It had one of his videos was a oral history by a former Palestinian who grew up in Israel and her history and her family and what they went through. And that insulted many people. They had one in particular which I think caused a lot of trouble. They had a video of people asking in Jerusalem, the experience I had too, by the way, when I was there, in Jewish Jerusalem, in Israeli, well, they're both Israelis in one sense, in Jewish Jerusalem, I'm talking ethnically now, rather than Palestinian Jerusalem, for an address which was in fact on the side in Palestinian Jerusalem. Nobody knew it. Nobody knew anything about it, never heard of it, don't know. And they'd walk away. Don't know. Never heard of it. Don't know. Now, some of it may have been what I call the suburban life, where you can be in a suburb and ask somebody where something is that's two blocks away, and if it's not on his car ride to work or to the train, they won't know. But it wasn't that, obviously. They asked a bus driver. He doesn't know. I think they asked a cabbie. Oh, he does. He has no idea. It was very striking, the kind of isolation, mental isolation, of what was technically part of Israel. And that irritated a lot of people. The result was, I think the GAUF threatened to withdraw support. The head of the museum left, was replaced. They're no longer doing exhibits of this kind. And I was very sorry. I think Spertus is a great institution. It's a fine school, and it has a great library. And I think there's nothing wrong with showing points of view that you don't necessarily agree with, including, particularly, there's nothing wrong with criticizing your own people. You know, if you, people who didn't criticize their own people in Germany became Nazis. You have to criticize your own people. Because if you don't, outsiders, you know, they're just going to hate your people. So, but anyway, that was the, that's been the history of Spertus, but still a great institution.
Now, what has been important for you to pass on to your children and grandchildren about Jewish identity and your Jewishness?
I wasn't very successful passing along anything about Jewish identity to my son, who was technically not Jewish, of course. Mother wasn't. And when he married somebody who was not Jewish, and he eventually converted to stay with his family, I think. But when he was in college, not at my urging, he took a number of courses in Jewish history. And I don't know if he's read much Jewish literature in translation. I have no idea. And it was his idea to do the cemetery project. There's no denial there. So passing along identity, consciously, no. But I'm told he's very much like me in all kinds of ways, including some he wishes he weren't.
And have these trips back to Poland changed your view about your own past there, or reinforced any ideas that
you
had?
I think they were part of my return to interest in Jewish matters that I didn't have as much. I think for this way, there's a woman who did the legal work for me, pro bono, who's not Jewish, and her sister is very active in all kinds of Jewish and non-Jewish matters. She's a filmmaker. She has made some wonderful films about survivor histories. Again, I'll send you the name because I don't remember names anymore. I know her very well. And she wanted actually to make a film of me in connection with the cemetery project. And I agreed, but it never came to anything. Part of it, this other film was started, and I said, look, let's not do the two at a time, let them do theirs. And I think it just didn't work out. So, which is fine with me. I was very hesitant anyway. And I wanted a film on the project, but on me, anyway. But she told me, look, you're somebody who's rediscovering Judaism, your Jewish identity. I said, what do you mean rediscover? I've always been aware of it. Me, just rediscovering it, and you know. And for that matter, you know, my mother, I was almost 35 when she was killed. I was 33, almost 34. I wasn't a kid anymore, and I was very close to her. She lived with me in Chicago for a couple of years when I first came here. That was short, not long after my father had died. And she was sort of at loose ends. And I knew her world. She didn't force me into it, but it was part of the world. I knew her friends. After the shock of her death, I didn't stay in touch with her friends. I should have, but I didn't. They wrote me, you know, grievance letters, and that was that. But that was still part of my environment. So it's not as if I somehow moved away and lived in a totally different universe. I would have been more so if I'd returned to Montreal. I wanted to go back to Montreal. My goal, I couldn't get a job in Canada. I've later learned that my field, at that time Canadian universities were only in history, were only hiring people in French, English, Canadian, and maybe in U.S. history. But they were not hiring. In fact, a friend of mine was a great lawyer. He was a Rhodes Scholar, he's a Jewish guy, and he wrote his dissertation on at Oxford, his PhD, on German-Polish relations, international relations in the 20s. He couldn't get a job in Canada, so he went to law school right away and followed his father, became a lawyer. But I would have gone back to Montreal. My plan was to go back to Montreal or Toronto after the war. I felt very Canadian. I didn't want to develop a still third identity, you know, having been Polish and then this and then this. As it turned out, I got this job, and I didn't get a job in Canada, and I stayed, and I got married, and I had a child, and so I just stayed. But if I had gone back to Montreal, I probably would have been active again in Jewish Public Library and things like that. Here, the Jewish institutions of Chicago were such, other than Spertus, didn't particularly attract me. They were either more actively Zionist than I would have been, or they were synagogal related, or there were others, but they were very far north in the Skokie and suburbs and so on.
What do you think is the future of Yiddish?
I don't know. I mean, my mother thought it would die out. And in one sense, she said, let it die out. You know, the world is gone, the country is gone, the people are gone, let it die out. This is just, I remember the son of a friend of ours who was one of them went out and taught Yiddish in, I think in Oregon or something. And she said, oh, what the hell is this doing this for? Who wants it? Who needs it? And, Verwochtes. He later became very eminent. I won't mention his name. And then there was another one who was the son of a good friend of ours. Again, there was a Yiddish paper in Montreal. Oh, by the way, my mother was a subscriber to the Vorwärts, the daily, and there was a Yiddish paper, the Kanada Odla. So we always got the Kanada Odla and Vorwärts and Montreal Star. And occasionally a French paper. His son decided to go into Yiddish theater, and he moved with his wife and young kid to New York to go work in Yiddish theater. And again, my mother's reaction was, what a waste. The talented guy, what's that for? And this is a lover of Yiddish. So she didn't have the sense of maintain the continuity of Yiddish. Her sense was Yiddish was fated to die out. And, you know, it's sort of a little bit like a relative you see who is on life preservers. Cut them off. I mean, you know, it's time. It's time. I mean, it's fine as long as they're conscious of doing things. She goes to Evo, she supports it, this, that. But none of this illusion that life, that this fancy new antibiotic will bring you back to life.
And what do you think?
I don't know. I don't see the future of Yiddish as what I would consider a living language. A living language is people, it's a language you speak when you go to a store, that you speak at home, that you speak with your friends. Not your only language, but a living language. I mean, Farsi is a living language in some parts of the world and among immigrants. I don't see that in America, and I don't see that in Israel, though I don't know Israel that well. Visits and reading about it, it's obviously, as you've pointed out, no longer as negatively viewed as it used to, but it's not negatively viewed as an academic subject. I don't think the public schools of Israel teach Yiddish, right? And nobody has Yiddish theater as a major event in. So I don't see that many of the Russians knew Yiddish, but I don't know how many of them actually speak Yiddish. I think they speak Russian or Hebrew in the next generation. In Israel, I don't think there's much Yiddish spoken by Russian immigrants. They're the old ones, but they're too old. So I don't see it as a living language. Would it ever be revived? I know, you know, Hebrew was not really a living language for much of the time, but it was something because men learned it. You prayed in it all the time. You wrote it. The men wrote it. The women wrote Yiddish. The men wrote Hebrew. In that sense, it was a living language, though not one where you went to a restaurant and ordered in Hebrew.
Right.
Even in Orthodox Warsaw.
Okay.
So I don't see, but I'm interested in what it is. If I was given where I am now, if I was 30 years younger, I might have decided not to go into law, but to really learn some background and become a Yiddish historian. I might have done that then, given my interest in 30 years ago, in the 70s, almost 40 years ago. And I'm now 77, when I was in my 30s, I was getting there. And if there had been this kind of the situation there is now, I might have very well moved into that area. But again, more as an academic thing. Because, let me put it this way, nobody is keeping alive the Yiddish culture of Poland or Lithuania. This is not the culture of a language. It's the culture of a people. That people is gone. It's very much, culture lives on. So the culture of the Yiddish Ashkenazic world lives on in America all the time. That's the businesses Jews do, the education. We're all Talmudists in one form or another. My wife keeps complaining that I ask too many questions. You laugh. So the culture lives on, and it will live on. Will it ever revive? I don't know. Let me finish this by telling you a history of culture, my view of culture. In the ancient world, Christian world, probably the most important, most widespread, most established heresy was Manichaeism. Manichaeism was the view that God does not control the world alone. God and Satan are both in control. They're fighting. And God will win at the end. But there's good. It's a much more rational explanation for evil than seeing evil as somehow the will of God. So God's will does not rule the world. And that was very strong in North Africa. You can see remnants of that in the writings of St. Augustine, who grew up in that kind of atmosphere, and in southern France. In Europe, on the continent, very strong in southern France. It died out. I have been told, I'm not a detailed medievalist who checks the maps and so on, but I have read and I have been told that probably the next big heresy in Western Central Europe, there are others, was the Albigensian heresy in southern France. I'm not quite sure what it was about. What I know best about it is it was rooted out in a mass crusade, the Albigensian crusade, when a great many people were killed. It was in the same areas as the Manichaean, maybe 800 years earlier, 700 years earlier. Could be a coincidence. And then when Protestantism came to France, and we often forget that France was once almost a majority Protestant country, Huguenot, Calvin was French. Its center was southern France, not northern France. The same area as 300 years earlier had been Albigensian, and 600 or 700 years before that, Manichaean. So culture lives on in a way. I don't know what the connections are between the three, but these coincidences one finds not infrequently. And so, yes, the culture lives on, but it's not the old culture. So if you ask me what I think of the future of Yiddish as a language, as a living literature, I don't know. Are there many people, talented writers under 40, writing in Yiddish?
A few.
You would know better.
A few,
okay. The major writers I can think of my generation, no, except those from Grada, and the next one, did not. Philip Roth was a very Yiddish writer, but he didn't write in Yiddish. Saul Bellow was another very Yiddish writer, not just a Jewish writer. He was not a Sephardic writer, but he did not write in Yiddish. So, will it live on as a living literature? I don't know. But will it be preserved as a culture, and will people know more about it and study about it? I would love to see more. What I haven't seen in the courses on Yiddish is courses just on Jewish life in 17th and 18th century. There's a teacher at, she may be at Smith, a Polish woman, not a Jew, who teaches Jewish history, who has done very interesting work on Jewish-Gentile relations in 18th century Poland. She's either, name me some other women's colleges.
Smith,
I think
Vassar.
She's Smith.
Holyoke.
She's not Vassar.
Wellesley.
Which one?
Wellesley, Mount Holyoke.
I think she was at Smith. I know where she is now.
Scripps?
No. It was one of those sort of Ivy-ish schools, I think. I might have been another one. I don't know. And she gave a lecture in Chicago at some, I don't know, was it Spertus, was it something else? But anyway, and I read some of her stuff. Fraunhofer may have been at the University of Chicago, I don't remember. And she pointed out, first of all, that the notion of rigid separation of Jews and Poles in the 18th century was almost geographically impossible. All of Warsaw, she showed on the map, in the 18th century, had a physical size equal to one district of Paris. Now, there's only so much separation you can have when everybody lives within walking distance of everybody else. And in the small towns, all the more so. You didn't have ghettos. You had the Jews lived together, as they do America too, very often. But there were certainly no ghettos for 12 families in a small town, in a shtetl, small town I'm not even talking about the villages, a small town of, you know, a few hundred, a couple of thousand was a big town. And pointed out there was a huge amount of intermarriage. But of course, the intermarriage disappear. So you don't know about it as much. But there had to be. And then she talked about particularly the close relationships between wandering Jewish peddlers and Polish bandits. And Polish bandits. She talked about the close relations between wandering Jewish peddlers and Polish bandits. Because the peddlers were the advancemen. They would scope out the village. The town, what's going on, where to do, where to grab, what to rob, and they'd inform the Polish bandits. And the Polish bandits would then come in and pay a fee to the advance man. So there are all kinds of interrelations that aren't talked about. And that was the old world, it's not till the 19th century that it became, in fact, in many ways, the Polish anti-Semitism goes back a long way, the Ukrainian much longer. It's not till the 19th century that a kind of an intellectual anti-Semitism, that the church became much more anti-Semitic, and that more the separations, and that a Yiddish culture developed. Too, that was self-conscious and different.
Well, I want to ask you about leaving Israel.
Oh, my anecdote about leaving Israel and Yiddish. I was there with my son and his daughter about, 10 years ago maybe? Just before their daughter was born. So she's 11 years ago. And we went all over, and it was very exciting. I didn't see my relatives. I was with them, and that's another trip which I planned. I haven't done it yet, but I will. And we had a Tel Aviv. This goes back to my Hebrew, right? The immigration guy, you know, the securities guy, asked me. He said something to me in Hebrew. I said, I don't know Hebrew. I'm sorry, I don't know Hebrew. You don't know Hebrew? No. But you must know. I mean, you had your bar mitzvah. So I said, no, I never had a bar mitzvah. He looked at me very strangely. He said, oh. I'm sure there are Jews in Israel who don't have a bar mitzvah too, someone. But, oh. Then I wanted to prove my reality as a Jew. I said, I don't know Hebrew, but I do know Yiddish. And you know what he did? He took my passport. That was a sign of danger. I may be a terrorist. I know Yiddish, but I don't know Hebrew. And he had our passports, and then he took my son's and hers. I don't know if he took theirs or they simply didn't know whether to travel without. But my passport, they kept for 2.5 hours. And got them back just in time to catch the plane. Okay, so don't offer information that you're not asked for. So Yiddish culture in Israel, who knows?
Right.
It's the culture of dangerous people. For all we know, they might be, you know, peaceniks.
Right. Well, I just have one question that I like to ask everyone. Do you have a favorite Yiddish phrase, a saying, or oystruk of some sort?
Oy vey, of course, which is, of course, not originally Yiddish. It's a Slavic expression. And in fact, naturally, I don't say oy vey. I say oye. I've learned to say oy vey. The Polish is oye. And I learned that it was a Slavic expression from a student of mine who is a Vulcan. And she used a similar expression. And I said, where'd you learn that? She said, oh, every Slavic language has that. And I found out that it's true. Everyone has a variant. And oy vey is really Polish oye or Lithuanian, whatever, with vey being the German word, Yiddish word. I had some. But my memory for things like expressions has gone down in the last few years. And I would probably scramble it, as I do English expressions. Whenever I use one, I get the words mixed up. No. But I never had too many favorite expressions. But there were some I could have cited, just to cite some, but I can't do that now.
Mm-hmm. And do you have an eitzah, a piece of advice for the future generations?
I think people should not forget their past. And they should know that they bear, not just genetically, but culturally, their past. And there is and to be conscious of it is important. I believe in knowing your country's history, and I believe in knowing your culture's history. And I think people should do that. I think people do. How can it be preserved? I certainly think that universities are part of it, though the other side of it is they're being relegated more and more into a combination of trade schools and humanities centers. And I don't know how much is being kept alive in a real sense. That has nothing to do with just the Jewish, but generally it's a problem that they're all facing. Things change. They're not the way they were 50 years ago. I don't know how they'll be 50 years from now. My mother once said to me that she wouldn't mind dying if she was the last person on earth. But she just wishes she knew what was going to happen. She wants to be there. I'd love to be around to know what's happening 50 years from now, at least, not to mention 500 years from now. But one thing that's sure, it's nothing anyone else can predict.
Well, Shainam Naung, thank you very much for making this time and sharing your story with me and with the Yiddish Book Center.
Shainam Naung, it's Eichel.
You've been listening to an interview from the Yiddish Book Center's Wexler Oral History Project. To learn more, visit yiddishbookcenter.org.